Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your gotcha Mercedes-Benz, but that don't make you driven. Of music, news, and criticism, I am your host, John Caramonica. It's getting late, and I'm struggling to let go. Although there's distance between us, there's no place I'd rather be. You know we had to scramble the jets. There's a Drake album, it's called Honestly Nevermind. It came out on Friday after being announced a few hours earlier. You were listening to Flights Booked coming in. This is a Drake dance album, which at first seems like a hard pivot and is a bit of a pivot if you think about the big picture. But also, Drake has been telling a story about the intersections, certainly of R&B and dance music, and also a little bit less so of hip hop and dance music. Drake's been telling that story on and off throughout his entire career. First segment is going to be your friend and mine, Joe Coscarelli, coming to talk big picture about the album. And then on the back half, Lawrence Burney is going to call in, and we're going to have a conversation about Drake's use of Baltimore Club, Jersey Club, and also tell the story about how those genres have intersected with the mainstream on and off for the last couple of decades. But first, Joe is here.
Guys, hold on a second. I don't mean to be an a-hole about this, but are there only 14 songs on this new Drake album? I'm being serious.
Do you feel like there should be 28 songs? Like, you're confused.
It's this one.
It's like, it's Frank Ocean, it's Endless, and then there's a blonde like hovering around the corner, you think? Yeah, I don't know.
I regret having asked.
It's true. A Drake album under an hour.
Yes. Although on the dance floor, music lasts forever is, I think, what I would say. Joe's here. Hi.
I'm back.
Freshly shorn, freshly vacationed.
Mm-hmm.
Joe, where were you, if I could ask such a personal question, where were you when Honestly Nevermind dropped? Because I'll tell you where I was, but where were you when Honestly Nevermind dropped?
I was in the Medina in Tangier, Morocco. When I got the news that the Drake album would be dropping, got a DM from my friend Brett, big Drake fan, shout out to Brett, and he was the one to break the news to me. So then, you know, I was 5-6 hours ahead, so I went to sleep. I woke up in a hotel, you know, 7 a.m., bright and early, still a little, you know, my internal clock was off, so I was first one down to the breakfast buffet, and I was sitting on the patio overlooking Tangier, having some coffee and croissants, listening to a new Drake album and laughing to myself as I was realizing what was going on and what kind of album it was going to be. And then only a few days later did I realize that I'd been listening to it wrong, basically. Because actually, I didn't think I'd ever say this, but a Joe Budden tweet really caused me to reevaluate my feelings about this Drake album and come in with fresh ears. Did you see this tweet?
No, I saw the academics post. What did Sir Budden have to say?
I think Joe Budden tweeted, I'm trying to find the exact words, but he said something like, "You guys are reviewing a dance album from bed at 2 a.m. LOL."
Wait, did he mean bed the location or bed the club?
He did not mean the club. He meant one's bed, one's laptop and one's bed. And I realized that 7 a.m. at a all-you-can-eat breakfast buffet in Morocco was just a weird headspace to come into this at.
To be fair, Joe Budden was tweeting about me.
Yeah, yes. You and everybody else.
Yeah, I was in a hotel room in Richmond, Virginia. I downloaded it when I was driving back to the hotel on my phone. I was downloaded onto my phone and I started playing it in the room as I was like, I had gotten to the room late and I was unpacking. I started playing it and I'm listening to the first song or two and I'm like,
how did, like, where did the algorithm take me? The algorithm started playing a different album. Like, this is not the Drake album. Like, the vocal treatments, like, none, this is not a Drake album. Or maybe this, maybe the intro was from a Drake album, and then it, like, put me somewhere else. But in fact, a Drake album, honestly, never mind, a New York Times critics pick, I should add. Drake's seventh studio album, whatever that might mean in the Drake oeuvre, is, in fact, a dance music record that most people reviewed from bed. It is basically mainstream house music. It's like kind of, there's Jersey Club and Baltimore Club. He's nodding to African dance music, whether it's Afrobeats or Amapiano. So like tiny touches of ballroom in there. And it's a full album of that. This is not something that Drake has not done before, but it is certainly the intensity and the fullness of it is something he hasn't done before. And kind of coming on the back of Certified Lover Boy, which I think is universally regarded as fairly bloated and kind of end times album.
Which I want to talk about.
We'll reassess that. But the universe, I think the general take is that that felt like the end of something. This feels like Drake's, I don't want to say it's a full pandemic pivot, but it is Drake's. He is shaking himself out of stupor and by extension, shaking us and everybody who looks to him for cues out of their stupor.
I think that's right. Total palate cleanser to me. I think, you know, we're, 9 months from Certified Lover Boy?
Yeah.
Yeah, it came out in September. This very similar timeframe to when More Life came out after Views, which was also seen as a bloated, disappointing end times Drake album that had been highly anticipated, which, again, something worth talking about. But basically the same gap in time, right, when you get this dance-inflected palate cleanser for after a big major label album. I will give the exact word of the Joe Budden tweet since I found it because it's well written and okay. My paraphrase wasn't as good. He said, critiquing a dance album in bed at 2 a.m. don't sound nuts to y'all though? LOL. Which, you know.
Did he tweet that at 2 a.m.?
Probably. I think it was maybe a day or so later.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if it was a contemporaneous tweet. So, palate cleanse, yes. Now, obviously, like, we are in the Drake thinking too hard industrial complex. That's part of what we do.
Oh, yeah. Personally and professionally.
Yeah, and whatever other categories there are that have yet to be determined, much like digital revenue following CD, vinyl, and cassette, you know, some future revenues. When I was listening to this record, like, really with clear ears, I was trying to think about something that we've talked about on podcast previously, maybe on a mailbag episode or on the last Drake, or on prior Drake episodes, which are what are viable pathways forward for Drake in middle age? You know, he's 35 now. Drake is someone who is astonishingly astute as a listener. He's very curious. He has an incredibly flexible vocal style, but he's largely applied that over the years to hip hop choices and but slightly to R&B choices. That's going to run out at a certain point. Is this, to your ear, the point where you think the pivot is really in another direction? Like, after this, are we not getting Houston Drake, Memphis Drake, apart from Jimmy Cooks, but are we not getting that anymore? Or is this kind of the Weekend, the Dawn FM thing, which is, I was bored in the pandemic, I need to try to do something, and, like, I'm not touring, and it kind of doesn't matter if this thing hits or not. At least that's the story that they're telling. I think they probably thought it was going to hit a little bit harder.
I think you're right that there's definitely been immediate managed expectations after the fact. I thought it was very pointed that when the album was announced, it said, you know, Drake's seventh studio album, making very clear for someone who has often blurred the lines between project, mixtape, Lucy's album. And he's always been very deliberate about playlist, right? He's always been very deliberate about what the capital A albums are. And I think that's often served him poorly because those are the ones that are seen as disappointments, especially post Take Care, right? I'm thinking Views, Scorpion, Certified Lover Boy. Those are the ones that are called bloated. Those are the disappointments. Whereas the universally praised ones over the years have been stuff like More Life and If You're Reading This and the tossed off in-betweens, right? The tossed off stuff.
Although truly nothing in the Drake universe is tossed off. It may be advertised as tossed off, but it is not in fact tossed off. And I do think part of the thing, it's not just that the albums are considered to be worse. The buildup to he's setting himself up for failure in a way.
Always.
Because he's always being like, this is coming. Views is coming. Scorpion's coming. And at a certain point, you kind of exhaust your goodwill a little bit, even for someone like Drake, who is like very widely admired and liked and generally respected, except in certain oddball circles. But it is a little bit of a, this is maybe the first time in which it's an album, but I'm doing it tonight. It's serious, but it's tossed off.
Exactly. And then immediately when you have some head scratching, when people hear it and they're like, whoa, this is not what I was expecting from Drake, let alone a Drake capital A album, then you immediately have the sort of course correction, right? And if you follow DJ Academics, to me, DJ Academics is like the Fox News for Drake, right? If Drake is Trump, then Fox News is DJ Academics. So you sort of like know what like the party line is by what is being broadcast from someone like that. And immediately you get a clip of Drake partying that night saying like, oh, you guys don't get this. You're just behind the wave. Like you'll catch up. We're already on to the next one, being like, oh, like we don't even care about this. A couple of days later, you get Academics saying again, and I don't know who his sources are on this or if he even has any, right? But he's saying this is actually a mixtape. It's just that Drake signed this new record deal.
A contract.
And he needs to fulfill albums. So this is, you know, this is a mixtape, wink, wink, you know, whatever. These words are meaningless. But I think that you have seen a bit of people putting their thumb on the scale in different ways about what this project means. To go back to your initial question, I do think that it is an experiment. It's tossed off. It's demos. It's not, I don't think we're going to hear a lot of this Drake in the future more than we have in the past, which is, which is fairly often. If you go back through the catalog,
there's two or three of these on every album.
Exactly. So I did today something that I did. And of course, it always comes back with Drake to Taylor Swift. But when Taylor made Folklore, right, we said, is this a new direction for Taylor? Is this her taking an old direction further? And I made this playlist, right, called Befolklore, which was like all the songs previously that I felt led up to it. So I did the same thing today with Drake, going through all the projects and the Lucys and taking like the songs that I feel like led to this point. And you're right that there's two to three on every album, and they're not always where you remember them. Like, weirdly, Views might have more of them than More Life. More Life is like a British rap album more than it is a dance album. And Views is a dance album more than it is like this chilly, wintry album that it's remembered as. And I think a lot of that has to do with marketing.
Drake is so famous and also so invested in pruning the shrubs of his public image in an active way that he just, because his music is taking this kind of path up, down, left, right, da, 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 the way that he is selling or advertising it is not always in line with that. And because he's so effective at delivering that message, that kind of chasm is almost always there. I'm forgetting the song on the current record, but there is one song on the current record that to me uses the same synth lines as Take Care, like the original Take Care with Rihanna. Let's listen to OG Drake, Take Care with Rihanna.
It's my birthday, I get high if I want to. Can't deny that I want you, but I lie if I have to. Cause you don't say you love me to your friends when they ask you, even though we both know that you do, you do. One time been in love, one time.
So I've got to assume that made your playlist or no?
Yeah, of course. I think that's, you know, a big moment.
Yeah. What are a couple other things? I was thinking about Passion Fruit, which I mentioned. There's a bunch.
But even if you start at the beginning, Find Your Love, the one Kanye record on Thank Me Later, to me, that's a very dance-oriented beat. You have it Take Care on the album of the same name. And then this is, I think, a big moment for Drake is when he starts working with Majid Jordan on Nothing Was the Same. You have Hold On, We're Going Home. And basically all of the records that they co-wrote on, you have his relationship with Party Next Door, which takes you through a couple albums, something like With You from Views. Even Legend a little bit from If You're Reading This, like just experimenting with different kinds of beats, like sort of somewhere between R&B and rap, different vocal deliveries. And I thought coming into this album that it's noteworthy that none of those guys seem to be on here or in the credits. These songs are not written with them, seemingly, the OVO sweatshop, as they're often referred to. And I think it's worse off without them, honestly. I feel like that's where this album is missing stuff for me, is the hooks and the melodies.
But I will say one thing, a lot of those records that you just mentioned to me are still gentle Drake records. And the one thing on this album, the beats are not gentle. And maybe this is because Carnage is doing the producers, Carnage, who Gordo is known to production now. But Carnage is kind of like a big room, hard, I wouldn't even say house necessarily, just like
EDM.
Hard.
It's EDM.
Yeah, it's like slightly soulful, like slightly edgy EDM, I guess, is what he specializes in. And so I was surprised at how square the corners were on a lot of these beats, because oftentimes when I'm thinking of Drake, I'm thinking of slipperiness. I'm thinking of synth clouds that are more potent than the drum patterns. And this is actually quite the opposite of that. We should play something that like hits pretty hard. Let's listen to a little bit of Massive. I often think that if we're talking about like Drake, the layering of Drake albums, often I'm thinking that the primary part is this kind of like undistinguished cloud of mood, whether it's synths or like a guitar or like weirdly tuned pianos or whatever. The bed is the dominant effect. The drums propel and the vocals are deliberately woven into that bed. This is maybe, I don't want to go so far as say is the only time, but certainly in recent memory where I feel like the beats are doing a lot more work than the kind of bed, even though the bed is there a lot of these songs, but the beats are doing a tremendous amount of work. And that's, I think, a perspectival shift for Drake, because I don't know if it's, hey, we're rushing this. I haven't written these songs really thoroughly. Let's give like a physicality to the energy. I don't know. I don't know if it's like, hey, everybody's locked in and this is a summer album and we're about to go crazy. Let's have something that knocks in the cars. It could be that. But I was really surprised, because as good as the drum programming is on Drake albums, I don't really think of it as percussive music in that heaviest sense.
Totally. And I think the choices that he's making vocally are that. They are choices, right? Like, he's doing the same thing more or less over most of these songs. And that's cutting out things that he relies on. These sort of R&B lilts, the instinct to go staccato and make little hooks or switch up his flow, even when it's sung, you know, he's not doing that. And I think the lyrics are simplified. They're very general. They're very mood based. They're not specific in that normal Drake way. They don't take you away from the music, and they don't really even, they're not the thing you're paying the most attention to.
There's not a lot of narrative. Like, I pulled out a few lyrics for the review that felt like very, I think I called it Instagram caption era Drake. There's still like a sprinkling of that, but it is by no means the dominant thing that he's doing. They are smears. It's like I find Drake's best writing painting with a very thin brush. These are like house paint brush lyrics.
Totally. And it's taking me a lot to get used to it, to be honest. Like, I would say the first 5 times I heard this album, I didn't think it was good because of the vocals. I feel like I'm just starting to understand it. And I think a lot of the rejection of this album that you've seen so far online are because it's just not something we've heard from Drake in terms of execution. And to me, it's the first Drake project that's better in concept than in execution. Usually, people's frustrations with Drake is a lack of concept, a lack of cohesion, or a reliance on things he's done before, right? A sort of hodgepodge. But it's always well made. Like, you're never like, Drake didn't do this on purpose. Like, he's always doing exactly what he meant to do, even if you don't think that idea is good. But to me, on a craft level, this feels like slightly subpar based on the level he's set for himself. It feels like an exercise, right? Like demos, like experiments, improv. And again, I think it's a choice. Like, I think if he wanted to make this album, if he wanted to add one hook, like the Feel No Ways hook, into every song on this album, he could have, but he didn't. And I'm curious as to why.
But to me, this is a choice that has a lot to do with the world that he has chosen to move into, which is dance music, which is sweaty. It is immediate. Obviously, there's narrative in vocals of a lot of club songs, but it's not necessarily driven by narrative as much as it is by mood, texture, scale, ambition, things like that. And so I feel like part of Drake's chameleonic gift is to create credible genre adjacent songs, whatever the genre that he is moving towards. And I think making a quasi Jersey club record that sounds sweaty, that's okay. Drake is willing to like let go of some of that perfectionism because it suits the production. I don't think if he was tossing off, let's say it was a 9-month gap and he put out an Afrobeats record, I don't think he would have had the same vocal approach. I don't think he would have had the same songwriting. And I think we know that Drake's a good enough songwriter that if he wants to sit down and pull together like a full narrative for each of these beats, he could do that. I mean, obviously, you know, you saw 40 on Instagram posting some stuff from the last few days. Obviously, this was cobbled together. I don't know if it was in 2 weeks or 2 months or 6 months, but it, you know, it was a relatively quickly pulled together project is what it seems. But I think that choice was deliberate and extremely in keeping with wanting to make a record that could be perceived as credible by the communities that he was making music like in communion with, even if he didn't use a Baltimore club producer, quote unquote, a Jersey club producer. You know, there's no like Mike Q records on this. You know, there's no ballroom producers or anything.
Just in terms of its timeline, there are a few references that date it within the last at least 4 weeks. You have references to Young Thug. You have a Nadal reference on there who recently won a major. The only one that's slightly out of time is when he mentions a James Harden step back on liability, which hasn't happened for a few years. So I don't know if Drake is too busy playing in his own basketball league to be watching NBA games. But
just okay, sidebar, does James, that's a move that James Harden doesn't make anymore? Or it's like referring us to a specific thing.
It's something that he was once known for that he now struggles with, which, you know, maybe Drake can relate to.
Welcome to the Ringer Podcast Network. We're John and Joe, and we're here to talk music and sports.
But I want to go back to what you said about it being credible to the people he's referencing, because I think that's spot on. And often what Drake has done when he borrows from subgenre, from underground specifically, is smooth down the edges, right? And make it palatable to much more people. He makes it Drake. He makes it pop. He makes it hit. He makes a New Orleans bounce song the number one record in the country for weeks on end. And I think you're onto something, that what he's doing here is specifically trying to make it grimy and a little bit difficult, right? This is the first difficult Drake album to me, at least as far as Drake albums go. You find it goes down easy?
Yeah, I didn't have any of the anxiety that I think you had those first couple listens. Like, I didn't have that. Like, I just genuinely felt, maybe partially because I was in a kind of like liminal place when I heard it. Maybe if I was like sitting at my desk or even in my own car, maybe I would have been parsing it. But I think maybe because I was feeling a little bit liminal, I was like, yeah, sweaty Drake club record. I don't know where I'm at. Like, I'm out in the field. Yeah, absolutely. Phenomenal.
Even something like the first full track, right? The first single, the one that came with the video, Falling Back, right? It's the vocal production is grainy in at least part of his vocals. And he's singing like behind the beat, especially in the end, like the outro that's dragged out. We should probably listen to a bit of it.
Yeah, let's listen to the outro. And also just a point before you pick it up, a point about outros on this record. There are probably more songs on this record where he is repeating one line or one sentiment like ad nauseum than I've heard on any other Drake record. And I guess you could choose to see that as lazy, or you could choose to see that as homage to and desire to participate in a genre where repetition is valued. Repetition, it's commitment. You're dancing, you're out there, you're hearing things. A lot of times in a club environment, I mean, this is a real old man in the club energy here, but like a lot of times in a club environment, you're not wanting a narrative to like, I'm going here, then I'm going there, and then I'm going there, and then I'm ending up there. You want something that's going to keep you moving, but staying where you are. You want something that's consistent, even as it's evolutionary. And so I think Drake's rejection of narrative and repetition on this album is like, it's a choice.
John, have you ever been to London? Have you ever been to London maybe in the late 90s?
Oh, man, play Sweet Like Chocolate. Play Sweet Like Chocolate right now. Finding a way in the dark. It's so hard when you're close to my heart. You are there when I'm feeling alone. All I need is for you to come home. You sweet like chocolate, boy. Sweet like chocolate. You bring me so much. Just know that the Sweet Like Chocolate CD single came out, actually came out after I moved out of London, but I went to the local garage record shop and I convinced them to sell me an early copy of it because I pleaded. I said, I'm getting on a plane back home and I have to bring this with me. So
do we think that Drake has been listening to Pink Panthers?
Oh, 100%.
He's making different choices than she is, but I wonder if he's into that.
You know who else he's listening to? Doja Cat.
Wow. Wow. You think?
Yeah, you don't think so?
I mean, if it was the Doja Cat school of dance revival, I think that we would be getting bigger, disco-y, shinier songs.
But it's more the concept. If you, Drake and Doja Cat have a tremendous amount in common. They're both legitimately good rappers who are not necessarily given credit for how good rappers they are. They both are thoughtful, maybe not the most powerful singers, but thoughtful singers, considered singers, right? They make music that's fundamentally hybrid that is often critiqued by people who are preoccupied with purism on one side or the other. They have a lot in common. There could be a best of both worlds, Drake and Doja Cat. And you can end up with like, right, you can end up with everything that's like on the one side, you're going to have like Immortal Technique type records. And on the other side, you could have like chic records and it would all fall within both of their skill sets. So I think maybe paying attention to that a little bit and saying, huh, that's a viable pop direction that's happening. I cannot continue to make drill records. Like I cannot make. And this is. Here's a little look into the process. I had to drive home from my trip because my flight was canceled on Friday. And I was voice memoing as I was listening to the Drake album. And I was like, this is an anti-drill record. This is like,
which you put in the review.
Yeah, which I put in the review. But it's like, it's reckoning with the inevitable direction. And in the review, I talk about it being his children's children. Because obviously his children are his inheritors. We've talked about them ad nauseum. We've written about them ad nauseum. His children's children are like, I don't want to do this anymore. What can I do that's disruptive? And I think obviously drill in the kind of like Pop Smoke crossover context would have gone in a similar direction to what Drake is doing. But I think when you think of like K-Flock and younger people who are in their teens or late teens right now, those aren't the records that are being made. They're being made with speed, but they're not being made with the same kind of like toolkit that Drake has provided a generation of musicians. And I think he's very mindful of that. Being like 40 years old doing drill records, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's not for him.
I agree. And there was another piece of Twitter criticism of this album that I thought was spot on. I think this morning from Kazim Famuide, who said we're at the point of the Drake album cycle. Yeah, Real Life Kaz. He said we're at the point of the album cycle where women tell you, nah, this is actually fire. And in the end, that's kind of all that matters, right? And I think like if anyone believes that, that like making songs for women is not a pander, but a purpose, it's Drake. And I think it does go in the face of a lot of the hip hop we're hearing of late, which is not to say that women don't like it, but is extremely male, extremely aggressive, extremely, you know, raspy, full throated. And this is the total opposite. And you're right that Drake never really could have dipped into the current drill. Drake was making drill records 2, 3, 4 years ago, but he was doing it from the UK side.
Obviously, he's worked with Five Yo. You know, Dirk, late, you know, late drill, whatever. But I have a memory of, I think it was Shawnee Bin Laden's manager posting on IG, maybe pre-COVID even, or early COVID. Someone had filmed Drake. Maybe it was Drake's on IG or Alive or something, listening to Shawnee Bin Laden in, like, again, 2020 or 2019.
Oh, of course. Of course he's listening. He hears everything.
He hears everything. It's very proximate. And I'm sure, like a technician, he's like puzzling out, like, how can I fit in? How can I work with? How can I adopt? How can I Migos Versace this? But we may be at the end of that particular arc of Drake. I don't know. He may come back with an entire drill record for all we know. And to be honest, if anybody is likely to be the person to figure out, oh, I made a New Orleans Bounce song number one, I bet I can make a K-Flock song number one, it's probably going to be Drake. But I just don't know if that's really what he wants, or even if that's, at this point in his career, sustainable. I mean, to me, what I thought, and I think we talked about this on a mailbag episode, like, can you imagine, like, a legitimate Drake Afrobeats album, like all Nigerian producers, obviously 40 overseeing it, but all Nigerian producers, all Nigerian co-writers and collaborators, genuine, like maybe some British stuff going on just to kind of like salt the diaspora a little bit. All of that together, I mean, that's like a number one album for 6 months. That's the actual direction that all of this stuff should be going.
I think you're right. And I think this is more of a left turn than that. And yet you still have these records on here that are Drake being Drake, right? Right in the middle, smack in the middle of this thing, you get Sticky, right? Which is the middle point between the dance experiments and a Drake hit, right?
It's a hip house record.
Of course. And then, of course, you get the last song, Jimmy Cooks with 21 Savage, which is just a Drake hit, a normal Drake hit. And it's the first time on the album because the album is not lyrically specific and temporally contemporary in the way that a normal Drake record is. He doesn't get to sort of address why he's making it until the first line of the last song when he says, F a pigeonhole, I'm a night owl. This a different mode, right? Like he's saying like, all right, you guys didn't like Certified Lover Boy. Here's a hit that's going to be on the radio all summer. Me and 21 Savage over Play a Fly. You know, we did it again with the Memphis stuff.
The pigeonhole, I'm a night out, it's a different mode. I'ma have to make a paint of six on a pinky toe. Heard you with a shooting guard, just let it know. I would have your court side, not the middle row. All good love in a minute though.
Before we continue, just talking about hip house for a second. And I think we also have to get into the Azalea discourse first, just like the fleetest of moments. But let's listen to Let It Roll by Doug Lazy.
Give me a mic, I get hype. Doug Lazy in spotlight, rhyme spill. I get ill and watch the records turn like a windmill. I'm on track when I hit this. As a matter of fact, I don't miss this target. I score like a marksman. Break down and I'm...
Hip house was a thing in the late 1980s into the dawn of the 1990s. There was a brief moment, never had huge mainstream centrist success. You can see flickers of it in some of the crossover, like club-oriented rap, Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock, not house artists by any means, but in terms of club and tempo, that was stuff that was moving. And then there were actual house productions sort of at the dawn of what we think of as house and techno, where people were rapping over those beats. Obviously, it's not the most storytelling rap necessarily, but like this was a movement. I don't know if Drake has listened to Doug Lazy. I don't know, but I highly recommend it. By all means, go listen to Doug Lazy. A lot of fun. But do you think Drake is listening to Azalea Banks? And I think Twitter also is very curious if Drake is listening to Azalea Banks, because I feel like one of the recurring tweet streams was basically like, Azalea can teach you how to rap on house records.
I think Drake loves Broke with Expensive Tastes. Like, there's no way he doesn't, right? There's no way that's not getting burned in the OVO mansion, like in the compound, in the embassy. It's too good and it's too original and it's too up his alley for him not to mess around with that, don't you think?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I'm waiting. Has Azalea tweeted about it?
I think Azalea is suspended from Twitter again. I could be wrong.
I don't know. Okay. I mean, I just feel like, well, a lot of people are like tweeting on her behalf, if not her.
She has many representatives. Can we do 2 minutes on Certified Lover Boy just while we're here?
Yeah. Oh, yes, of course. Yes. You want to reassess the reassessment of Certified Lover Boy. You think it's a masterpiece.
I think it's really good. I think it's as good as any other major Drake album. I think it has some of his sharpest brags. I think it has some of his sharpest anxieties. To go ringer for one more moment, like it's LeBron on the Lakers. And it's weighed down, I think, where the bloat is in the features. But I think it has some of the best Drake songs of the last 5 years. I think Love All minus Jay-Z, amazing. TSU minus the R. Kelly sample in the background, amazing. In Too Deep with Future, amazing. Pipe Down, Race My Mind, Get Along Better, Fair Trade without Travis Scott. It's a good album and people are going to remember that they like these songs in 3 years. I think it was the wrong album for that moment. I think the pandemic was supposed to be over and it was not over. I think that Drake is very annoying to people and was at his peak annoying after like 2C Slide, which isn't on the album, but.
And also the album cover of CLB.
The album cover. I think it was bad timing. I think it was a bad rollout. I think it was bad marketing, much like Views, which is maybe one of the better Drake albums. Look, I just think Certified Lover Boy is a stand-in for what people are sick of with Drake, but I don't think it is a bad Drake album.
Okay, I will repeat something. I don't know if I hear what you're saying. I accept it. I don't know if I agree with it, but I will say something about how Drake albums age, broadly speaking. And I've talked about this in previous writing about Drake, and I feel like I'm sure we talked about it. More than really any other artist currently working, Drake has his own grammar. He literally has a special keyboard, like a soundboard, that's like specific Drake sounds and ideas. Now, when we get a new record, oftentimes, I think what we're listening for are variations from the soundboard. We're listening for innovations. Are we listening to, hey, he's putting together familiar ideas in new ways? Sure. But mostly we're kind of like, huh, didn't expect that. Didn't see that coming. Didn't know you'd sample that. Didn't know you'd go in this direction. Didn't know you cared about Play a Fly. Of course, we know he cares about Play a Fly. There's that. But in terms of how Drake records age, from a distance, what you hear is the soundboard. What you hear is the familiarity. Listening to a random song off CLB right now, I'm not even sure I could tell you. I might hear it and be like, was that on Scorpion? Was that on View? Was that like somewhere two-thirds into More Life? Because he's fundamentally remixing ideas that are his ideas. They're his sounds. And so you could plausibly make a total mashup Drake playlist of the last prior to this album, the last five or six projects. And apart from the big singles, you could put together a playlist, take off the album tag, and a lot of these songs could have fit on any of the albums because the Drake idea is a Drake worldview. That's the thing. And so maybe part of what you're saying about CLB actually being very good, maybe it's because if you listen to it with an ear for the broadness of Drake's catalog and the specificity of his soundboard, it makes a lot of sense. But in that moment, the ways in which it iterated were not either sufficient or exciting. I'm speculating.
I think that's totally right. And I think ultimately the argument I'm moving towards, which I'm not going to make now, but we should, you know, we'll have another Drake podcast, I would venture to say before we hang up our headphones, is that maybe Drake is a singles artist and not an album artist. And I don't even mean singles in terms of radio singles, but I mean he's a songs artist. And the reason we've never gotten the quote unquote classic Drake album is because he's given us 150 plus songs with a capital S, you know, and maybe we never needed an album from him. And I think, you know, when history looks back, I'm just, again, putting it out there tentatively, that when history looks back, we're going to remember Drake for his four disc greatest hits, not for his albums.
I'm just looking at the full discography. Nothing Was the Same has to exist as an album. Thank Me Later.
Yeah. But in that moment, right, they're so tied to the moment. And I think, like you're saying, like with more space, with more time, with more distance, it's just a lot of good songs, you know, and I don't know really how the arcs work. But I do think what you're saying about the grammar is interesting, specifically to bring it back to Honestly Nevermind, because that grammar is not really here, right? It's here in bits and pieces. But I think part of what's taking me a while to understand about it is that it is a different language for Drake.
I think we could quibble over that a little bit, because to me, the first time I listened to this album, I was like, it's fresh, it's sweaty, and it's radical. By listen number five, I was like, I know this guy.
I agree. It's revealing itself as it goes. And I'll be interested to know, you know, I don't know if people sit with albums for a month or 3 months or 6 months at this point. They certainly didn't with Certified Lover Boy.
Did you know that Kendrick Lamar put a record out 3 weeks ago?
And I could imagine that Drake is going to just hit us again by the end of the summer with something else if he wants to. He already mentioned on OVO Radio that he was going to drop another Scary Hours.
Lucy
Pack. So who knows? But I will be interested to see how people feel about this. A, once it does get some burn in actual clubs, RIP Kinfolk, as a lot of people tweeted when this came out. But also just, yeah, how this works in the long arc of Drake history. Because I think 2 a.m. from bed, 7 a.m. from the hotel. That's not where this album will live, ultimately, if it lives at all.
And to that point, before we go, I was DMing today with a couple different DJs who both said that these records were effective in a club environment this weekend. And also it opened up the set to much more dance, quote unquote, music. It did for dance music kind of what Dua Lipa or Doja Cat couldn't, which is basically bring it back to Black tradition, bring it back to Black queer tradition, and tie it into like these broader hip hop and R&B, quote unquote, open format sets, like moving back in that direction. So it'll be interesting to see what the summer sounds like. And I hope to see you out on the floor.
Me and you. Can't wait.
Thanks, Boo Boo. We'll be back in just a sec with Lawrence Burney.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. Lawrence Burney is here. Lawrence, welcome back to Popcast.
Thank you for having me.
If you've listened to Popcast before, you know he's been with us. Lawrence is now the arts and culture editor at the Baltimore Banner. And also, if you are not familiar with True Laurels, which is Lawrence's ongoing project documenting Baltimore music and art and culture, get involved, truelaurels.com, go check it out, buy a magazine, et cetera, et cetera. When this record came out, when this Drake record came out, I was like, damn, I really like wish someone would just kind of talk about all the club references. And then I woke up on Sunday or Monday and Lawrence had done a whole thing talking about the club references. Thank God. So here we are. It was Pieces on Vulture. I appreciate that. The Pieces on Vulture, we just were listening to in the transition, Shake It to the Ground. That's DJ Blackstar and Rai Rai. And we're listening to that because the vocal ad lib, the what, that's Rai Rai on this record, is used on the Drake album, but in a song called Currents. Let's actually listen to just a touch of Currents to hear both the what and also the Jersey Club Bed Squeak.
In your own time, would you show me something, please, babe? Don't want to wait in vain.
So, Lawrence, when I first heard Currents, my hair was standing up. I was like, okay, we're in uncharted Drake territory, not uncharted musical territory, but certainly for Drake, who is someone who we have always paid attention to. And we know that he has his eyes on like 30 different subcultures at once. Tell me, before we get into the specific politics, tell me about your take aesthetically on his choices on this album, on these club choices.
You don't know that Drake is eyeing a subculture that you find yourself connected to or part of until he actually does it. So in your mind, it's like, okay, I don't know if people are really going to do like a club music in the way that I'm familiar with it. And you definitely don't expect Drake to do it. So I think it's fun to hear him toy around with this kind of production. I mean, the execution, we can all kind of go back and forth on whether or not it was good. I don't know. I look at this more like the way I look at a More Life or Dark Lane tapes kind of thing. I know he's calling it an album, but I kind of suspect this is something that Drake already kind of had in the vault. And I don't know if the rumblings about Beyonce's dance music record accelerated his rollout plan, or, you know, I really don't know what it is. I mean, you can never discount anything because it's Drake and he does toy around with a lot of different genres. But I will say that I'm pleased because I feel like the Baltimore club community online, or just the Baltimore music community online, over the years, I've always been a proponent of rappers using club music production, because I think that we've had so many, not so many, but I will say the few Baltimore artists, rap artists that have been able to make some kind of little mainstream moment, no matter how short-lived it is, I think they tend to interact with club music, whether it not be a club beat or from a producer that specializes in club music. And I think, I would say over the past like decade, there's been a scene developing locally that doesn't rely on club music the way that we used to before. And that's, it's fine. I'm a huge fan of it, obviously. I always wish that Baltimore artists, especially the ones that are super hot in the city, that rack up six-figure views on a regular basis, would at least like try to go for club music a little bit more.
Well, club music has been around so long at this point, it could plausibly be your father's music. If you're 16, you might be like, oh, well, my man, teenage club music. Yeah, right. So it's interesting that there are artists who do engage with it, but I imagine, like you say, with some younger artists, maybe it's a little bit like, we don't mess with that.
Yeah, or it's like, I hear that at a cookout.
Or yes. Ooh.
It's so embedded in the culture for the past 30 years that everybody's connection to it is not the same. And I think sometimes people recognize it, but they might not want to make it, or they might not want to interact with it in the same way. And they might like it still, but it's just not the way that they want to communicate musically. And I think that's fine. And I will say that although Shake It to the Ground is an element of Currents, the actual production style is more in line with Jersey Club because of the beer squeaks.
At the point when Shake It to the Ground came out, Baltimore Club, this is not 1.0 Baltimore Club. Baltimore Club existed for many years before this era. DJ Techniques, Rod Lee. You want to give like a quick micro history of how Baltimore developed the club sound that ended up at this song? Because this song is, frankly, it's Diplo era. We're already down the road, frankly. So you want to give like just a quick micro history of kind of what was going on in the 90s into the early 2000s?
From what I know, just by reading, I mean, I was an infant, maybe not even, I was born in 90, so I can't speak to anything that was actually happening in that time outside of my own research and conversations with the OGs of the club music culture. But from what I understand, in the late 80s and early 90s, Chicago house, I mean, house music was already really big in Baltimore in the clubs. And around the late 80s, early 90s, DJs started developing like the breakbeat. And they were using Chicago House Records and really utilizing those breakbeats to kind of create their own musical language, which would eventually become club music. And I know that in between what we know now as club music and when house was still king, there was a brief moment of a subgenre called hip house, which was kind of rap music, rap over house music. If you really want to like look into what Drake is doing with like the kids out of Philly and Jersey right now, I think hip house is a nice historical reference for that kind of middle ground. But once the early 90s hit, you had people like Frank Ski, who was a radio personality. He came out with the song Holes in His House. That's the song that WAP with Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion samples. That's like super early Baltimore club, where it's like, it feels, honestly, some of it, some like a Frank Ski style feels almost like New Jack Swing to me.
Oh, interesting.
It has that kind of vibe. And then on the other side, you had DJs like Scotty B and Sean Caesar, who went on to start Unruly Records. And they were kind of early in that development as well. Watch Out for the Big Girls by Jimmy Jones, which Lizzo named her new Amazon show after.
This is not the first dance with mainstream attention that Baltimore Club has had. You point this out in your piece. We were talking about the Diplo era very briefly, MIA. There were previous moments and have been, and I had actually totally forgotten about the Kanye DJ class thing. I also attended the one DJ class gig in New York right around that time, and it was in a huge room and no one came, and it was really depressing, I have to say. It was, I think I wrote about it. I got to Google that. I think there's a piece about that somewhere.
Oh man, that's tough.
Yeah, it was a rough night. I felt for him. But it's been interesting because despite these flirtations that have come in from the outside, the sound has remained very regional. Has that been a choice? Have producers been like, we're more invested in the community? Is it a choice that's inside out or outside in?
I think it's an ongoing battle. I think that obviously club producers want that sound to have a global reach. And I think a lot of them do. One of the beautiful things about club music is the fact that it's a form of electronic music. So I don't think it has as many bounds around it. as far as who has access to it. And I think that even the what from Shake It to the Ground, making it to a Drake album, kind of speaks to the ubiquity and the power of club music, regardless of what little pocket of the country is from, because the driving force behind a lot of club music is that you take these little tidbits of pop culture and musical moments and you kind of mash those things together to make something. Baltimore is not really a major city. It's under 600,000 people in the city. Music is not one of the things that is really nurtured by local government. It's not really given many resources. A lot of people are really kind of, you know, moving as individuals in the pursuit of making it out musically. So I think that obviously gives you a roadblock. I do think that some artists that have had the opportunity to break out, maybe their run wasn't that long. You know, there are people that have made waves, like Tay Cobain, for instance. His breakout song, Bankrolls, that was produced by Rod Lee, one of the most well-known club music producers there is over the past 20 years. And that got him a deal with 300. He's been on tours. His solo rap career didn't become what some people might think, but he's found a second leg of his career as a producer. He's produced on a couple of Nicki tracks recently. I believe he wrote on a Lil Baby track recently. I just think that, you know, in TT the Artist, Dark City Beneath the Beat documentary that came out on Netflix in 2020, I think that was a huge thing for the culture. And it also shows some love to, like, some people from Jersey, like Unique. I think that's small wins, but I wouldn't say people wanted to stay contained. I think some people have a bad taste in their mouths by certain moments that have happened in club culture, like when Diplo and MIA were kind of around interacting with people. And you know how that goes, especially in cities that are not really used to people kind of swooping in and collaborating. And I think, you know, some people get the benefits of those types of waves happening, and some people start feeling used and manipulated. And I think some people that might have sent people further into their shells, experiences like that. So it's a combination of things.
I have a memory of speaking of the Kanye DJ Class thing. Like, I have a memory, and if someone's going to fact check me on this, feel free to. But I feel like there was an interview around that time where Kanye is talking about Class and being like, I want him. Maybe it's Class talking about the experience and saying that Kanye was like, I want your drums, basically, like, leave your file. You want to talk about erasure or people like coming in and being like, I want the sauce, but maybe not in the way that you are getting it. Like, that was on people's minds. And that was like 2007 or whatever, which is kind of this era that we're talking about.
Yeah. And there's stories, and I don't want to say names, but there's stories of like really popular producers in that time of like the mid to late 2000s that were being approached by, you know, some music industry titans about signing on to them. And I've heard that some of these producers were afraid of their drums being stolen and not being given credit. And look, I mean, here we are with Currents, for instance, and Ra Ra was on Twitter talking about not getting credit for that. So it's still a very real and justified paranoia that people have.
Can we talk briefly about the Baltimore to Jersey pathway? And then on the tail end of that, Jersey and Philadelphia. But I think the Jersey stuff is key. The Bed Squeak, that's a Jersey thing, although, as you point out, it actually doesn't originate on a club record. It originates in a hip-hop record. Jersey, the tempos are really crazy. The intensity of the drums is very hard. I feel like the things I'm hearing on Honestly Nevermind remind me, big picture, maybe more of Jersey than of Baltimore in a pure sense, and also maybe like a touch of ballroom as well. But talk about the Baltimore to Jersey pipeline.
You know, Jersey is not that far from Baltimore. I don't think the average person in Baltimore kind of thinks about their proximity to Jersey. I think most of us kind of group it in with like a New York. No disrespect to Jersey. I just think that's the cultural overlap. I'm not saying that they don't have their own identity. It's the same way people group Baltimore and D.C. together. We're extremely close. We do have cultural overlap, but it's different. But from what I know is that a lot of Jersey DJs were fans of what was coming out of Baltimore. Maybe they heard some Baltimore people at their New York gigs or what have you, and they were coming down and getting the mixtapes that you could only find in the local shops. And from what I understand, DJ Tamil, who is obviously one of the pioneers and godfathers of Jersey, was one of those people who was always in town, always interacting with the Baltimore club DJs. And he eventually was part of Unruly. And I think he might have been the only Jersey guy that was part of that collective, which is All Baltimore Club. Tamil, in the late 90s, early 2000s, him and Tim Dollar were the people that were taking what they were experiencing in Baltimore and going up to Jersey with it, trying it out, speeding up the BPMs a bit, adding their own sauce to it, you know, and it kind of went from there. I think, in my opinion, over the past decade, Jersey has really developed its own club language that has taken on a life, a more sustainable life than Baltimore Club may have ever gotten to experience.
You put on a Drake remix by DJ Small 732. This is Chicago Freestyle, Jersey Club remix. Let's listen to a touch of this. And of course, Chicago Freestyle, this is a mellow record. Jersey Club is not mellow. This is a relatively, as you point out, a relatively mellow Jersey Club remix. There's also other remixes. Unique, who you mentioned earlier, there's Drake remixes that Unique has done that are much harder hitting. Do you think at all the Jersey Club viability and sustainability has anything to do with proximity to the New York radio ecosystem? Because I do feel one of the things that I've, in the last 3-4 years, that I've noticed is, especially on weekends and sometimes overnight mix shows, you have some DJs playing Jersey Club in this kind of like indistinguishable way. You know, when the set goes up tempo, all of a sudden there's 10 minutes of Jersey Club in there, which you would not have gotten even, I think, 5 to 10 years ago.
I'm sure it helps. And I say that because even when you look at what the Jersey Club rap scene of late, there's an interaction between New York City and North Jersey because they're right next to each other. So I think just naturally a New York person would gravitate towards something that, you know, they probably have family in Jersey or friends, or they might have went to school in Jersey. It's a natural progression, in my opinion. And also, even just from being on Twitter and kind of like the club music spaces, I've seen that there's even some disagreements there where I've seen Jersey Club producers and DJs kind of go on their tangents about how New York DJs will play Jersey Club to kind of get their party going, but won't book Jersey Club DJs to actually play it. I also want to point out the fact that I think a lot of Jersey Club figures have really pushed super hard on the internet, and I think they've sustained certain relationships. I think Jersey Club, the relationship to like the EDM world, even though I think that's obviously kind of an exploitive world in the electronic music space for Black music makers in electronic music. But I think it kind of, Jersey Club's rise with kind of like ran parallel with the rise of EDM. So, you know, I just think it was a perfect storm in a lot of ways, timeline wise. I can't attribute it to one thing, but for sure, I would say being closer to New York does help a bit.
You included a song that I had not heard. This is Shake That. It's Zassos and D-Sturdy. Give us the quick hit on Philly dance club teen stuff.
Philly geographically is kind of like a middle ground between Baltimore and Jersey. Club music is always from, and I didn't even notice initially. And it's funny because I didn't really know what Jersey or Philly club were until I became like a music writer. And I actually had to like interact with people and do more research. But growing up, I think because club music originated in Baltimore, I think we had such an insulated universe of our own renditions of it, and we had multiple generations of it, that we didn't really look elsewhere for it. So it wasn't until I started hanging out in New York and started meeting people from Philly, and they were like, oh yeah, we know about all the Baltimore club music. We would play at house parties, and they start naming songs to me. I'm like, oh, this? I had no idea. And even like with the whole Mad Decent involvement in club music, I wasn't aware of where any of those people were from. And I get older and I start to realize like, okay, all these guys were from Philly. And somebody even pointed out on Twitter with my Vulture piece that I didn't mention DJ Sega from Philly, which my bad on that. It's a roundup. So somebody's going to get left out. But yeah, you got the DJ Segas as well as Diplos and all those guys. Philly has always had a place in club music. There is Philly club music, which is a bit faster than Baltimore, but not as fast as Jersey. So I think the Zassosas and the Philly Ghosts of the World, it makes sense that this could happen in Philly. And I also want to point out that the producer for that track, DJ Crazy, is born and raised in Baltimore. He moved to Philly when he was a teenager. And from what I understand, spent a lot of his early adulthood in Jersey. So he, as a producer, has the experience of every facet and layer of club culture along the East Coast, which I think is really cool. And I think that's kind of like the biggest story is him being the producer. But that song, Shake That, has just been going crazy on the internet for the past 6-7 months. And they have the hips dance that goes along with it. The kids, the Philly Ghosts, they're kind of like a dance and rap crew. And I think their dancing is actually just as, if not more important than the song itself, because those are the kids that are making a splash on TikTok. I mean, my daughter is doing the dance and not really knowing where they're from. She knows that it's club music, but she doesn't know the ins and outs of it. And I think that's the interesting future of club music, is that obviously has a way more global reach. But I think the language of club music is changing, where, yes, before the BPM kind of was a help you distinguish where it was from. But now I think because of the internet, it's super fast and chaotic. So it's less about the BPM and more about what you can do to affect people with the music.
And also it's implicitly deregionalized. So when we were talking before we started recording, you were talking about your daughter and kind of absorbing this stuff on TikTok. And one of the things that's crucial about TikTok from a dance perspective, but also a music perspective, is it's inherently deregionalized. Your daughter doesn't know where the dances come from. Obviously, it's up to people like us to kind of like tell the stories and like dig up the lineages and genealogize things. But if you're 12 years old or 14 years old or even 16 or 18 on the platform, you may not be thinking, ah, this is a Jersey club tempo. Ah, this is a Baltimore club, familiar sample from Baltimore club. It's been deregionalized. And because of that, the hybridization that's happening is so much more rapid, which leads me to kind of where I want to end. And again, I was so happy to see Bandman Rill on your list. So Bandman Rill is making records that are at the intersection of drill and club. And the reason I was happy you put him on this list is because one of my main thoughts about the Drake album is its low-key anxiety about the rise of drill and where does he fit in with that? And or maybe sort of like tapping out even and just being like, nope, not it. Okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. Like, y'all have that. But the Bandman Rill stuff, and we'll play it at the outro, to me seems like if there's like a viable path for someone like Drake to get involved in like this current moment, Bandman Rill seems to have a template.
As you were saying, I was thinking what you were saying, the post-regionalism of club music. I think production-wise, that might be the case, but vocally, it's still very regional. Like, I think that Bandman Rill rapping the way that he does, which is more similar to New York drill. And now I can't really specify the difference between drill in the boroughs of New York City because it's not really my terrain. But at the very least, he sounds more like a New York rapper, but he's rapping on Jersey club. And I think that's what's interesting about the Jersey club rap as opposed to what's coming up. I mean, Philly has its own accent, obviously, but I think that, and they're even rapping kind of like on the drill tempo, I feel. But I think that accents are slightly different, so it translates differently. And I honestly wasn't even up on the Bandman Rill and McVert stuff until Alphonse Pierre from Pitchfork. He did a whole thing on Bandman Rill. And actually, Brandon Callender, the young writer based in North Carolina, he's the one that told me about the Philly stuff like months ago. I'm less knowledgeable of the Jersey club rap, but I'm more intrigued by it because of the crashing of influence that I can hear in it. And I always like when I can spot like multiple influences in one artist or one song. And I think the Jersey club rap, that's what makes it the most interesting to me. But I do see why a person like Drake could be drawn to it, because he obviously is into the UK drill scene, which is where the New York drill rap really comes from more than from Chicago and mop. And then with the club music kind of beat, we all know that Drake is always, at least for the past 6-7 years, always like to interact with dance music. So I can see that this clashing of cultures would be appealing to him, or at least like a blueprint.
Well, Lawrence, as always, I'm glad you're listening and paying attention. I'm listening and paying attention. And we know Drake is listening and paying attention.
Yeah, always.
That's our show. Thanks, Lawrence. Thanks to Joe. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email me at podcast@nytimes.com. Any of your favorite teen club TikTok dances. Get in the Facebook group. Get on the Discord. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content. Apple, Spotify, Google, etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Here's Bandman Rill.
When the song going drop, tell you should know that it's coming. No, I'm not blood, but you know how I'm coming. Blood of a word, this little punch ain't loving no strikes, ain't doing no nothing. Stay in, go watch your homie. Most of their shots, see me start getting bunny. So I'm thinking they don't even know me. Send you a driver, I'm acting the stolen. Damn.